The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver and Dan Novak. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Life on Earth faced an extreme test of survivability during the Cryogenian period, which began 720 million years ago. The planet was frozen over most of the 85 million year period. Scientists say Earth would have looked like a shiny white snowball in space during the deep freeze. But life somehow survived during this time, called Snowball Earth. A recent study offers a deeper understanding as to why. Fossils identified as seaweed were found in black shale, a kind of rock, in central China's Hubei province. The scientist said the fossils are a sign that livable water environments were more widespread at the time than they once believed. Nature Communications published the research this month. The findings support the idea that the planet was more of a slushball Earth with melting snow. This enabled the earliest forms of complex life to survive in areas once thought to have been frozen solid. The fossils date from the second of the two times during the Cryogenian period, when ice sheets stretched from the poles toward the equator. This period, called the Marinoan Ice Age, lasted from about 651 million to 635 million years ago. Huyue Song of the China University of Geosciences was the study's lead investigator and writer. The researcher said the most important finding was that ice-free, open water conditions existed in place during the last part of the Marinoan Ice Age. More extensive areas of habitable oceans better explain where and how complex organisms, such as multicellular seaweed, survived, Song said. The findings demonstrate that the world's oceans were not completely frozen. It means areas of habitable refuge existed where multicellular organisms could survive, the scientist added. Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago. The first single-celled organisms appeared in the first billion years of the planet's existence. Multicellular organisms arrived later, maybe 2 billion years ago. But it was only after the Cryogenian period that warmer conditions returned. That helped drive a quick expansion of different life forms about 540 million years ago. Scientists are trying to better understand the start of Snowball Earth. They believe a greatly reduced amount of the sun's warmth reached the planet's surface as its radiation bounced off the white ice sheets. I'm Katie Weaver.
In the Caucasus Mountains nation of Georgia, dumpling eating is a serious activity. I'm not Georgian, but the first rule I learnt when I came to Georgia was how to eat hinkali, said Sergei Shirinsky. He says he is now a dumpling expert. Georgian hinkali is a national symbol and source of pride. It is usually filled with a mix of raw ground beef and pork, as well as herbs and spices. It is then boiled and served hot. Hinkali is also the reason behind many mealtime debates. You should know that it's eaten with hands only. That's the first rule, Shirinsky says. Usually, eaters hold a single hinkali by its base. Its base is a collection of dough brought together during the folding process to bring the dumpling together. Then, eaters bite into the soft underside, being sure to eat any juices in the process. The second rule is no condiments, things added to give food a stronger taste. If you add something other than pepper, you can go to prison in Georgia, Shirinsky jokes. The exact beginnings of the dumpling in Georgia are unclear, but hinkali has been prepared in towns and villages across the country for centuries. Different areas of the country still argue over who invented it and who makes it best. Modern versions include a variety of different stuffing choices, like Georgian sulgini cheese, mushrooms, and potatoes. Hinkali making has also become popular among the millions of tourists that visit the country every year. In the capital, Tbilisi, retired Dr. Irina Jandiri offers cooking classes in her living room. It's fun, it's fascinating, and in the end, it is very tasty, she says. Every week, we have a hinkali day in our family. It's a great excuse to gather with friends and relatives, says Christine Mamasaklisi. She is a dance teacher from Tbilisi. Everything revolves around hinkali here, she says. This is not just a dish. It's an integral part of Georgian culture and identity. I'm Dan Novak.
American researchers suggest in a new study that humans will need to create very Earth-like conditions to survive for long periods in space. The study comes as the American Space Agency, NASA, prepares to return astronauts to the moon with its Artemis program. NASA recently announced its next crew of astronauts who will take part in a test mission to fly around the moon. In the more distant future, NASA plans to launch missions to Mars. The study was recently published in Frontiers in Astronomy and Space Sciences. It describes conditions that would likely be needed to support long-term human life in space or on other planets. The study was carried out by a team from Cornell University in New York State and the Norfolk Institute in Virginia. The study centered on issues such as dealing with gravity and oxygen in space, collecting water, developing agriculture, and getting rid of waste in space. One of the researchers was Morgan Irons, a doctoral student at Cornell. She cooperated with other scientists to explore important physical needs humans would require during future space travel. She said in a statement that life in space would require a natural ecosystem to support humans and their necessary equipment. Without these kinds of systems, the mission fails, Irons added. Another co-writer of the study was Lee Irons. He is Morgan's father and heads the Norfolk Institute, a group that seeks to work toward the resiliency of humans on Earth and in space. Lee Irons said one of the biggest problems for humans in space will be issues related to gravity. Humans experience lower levels of gravity in space. He noted that a lack of gravity can change the fluid pressure in living things. This can lead to health problems for humans living in space. An example of gravity imbalance would be the negative effect on the eyesight of humans in Earth orbit, Lee Irons said. This would be a problem in space because an individual would not have the weight necessary to keep the same fluid pressure the body was used to on Earth. The researchers said they first had to study the long-term physical needs of humans, both on Earth and in space. They are proposing that space mission planners seek to find ways to recreate the same evolutionary ecological networks that make Earth successful. Morgan Irons said billions of dollars could be wasted on setting up a space settlement only to see it fail. Because even with all other systems in place, you need gravity. She added, there is just no other place in space where there is 1G of gravity. That just doesn't exist anywhere else in our solar system. That's one of the first problems we must solve. 1G is another term for what scientists call normal gravity, or the gravity that exists on the Earth's surface. It can be measured as the rate of speed at which an object travels when falling to the ground, NASA explains. The team says oxygen is another important consideration. The researchers say space agencies would need to build high-technology main and backup oxygen systems to support long-term human life in space. But what if they fail? One suggestion from the study is to deploy living things to produce oxygen. Think of the hundreds of thousands of species of plants that make oxygen, Lee Irons said. He added that that kind of system would be needed to support long-term missions in space and on planets. The other main requirement would be a huge amount of energy from the sun, the study suggests. The researchers noted that as astronauts travel farther from the sun, they will be able to collect less and less solar energy. You'll need a lot of energy, Lee Irons said. Otherwise, powering the ecological system of an outpost will be like trying to run your car on a cell phone battery. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, Brian Lynn joins me to talk more about this week's science report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Of course, Ashley. Glad to be back.
Your report was about a study suggesting what conditions will be necessary to support humans during long-term space missions. Why don't we look at some words in the report that might be new for English learners?
Okay, sure. So let's start with the term resiliency, a noun. A basic definition would be the ability to become happy, healthy, or strong after difficult or bad things happen. It can also be used as an adjective, resilient, to describe a person or thing that is resilient. For example, resilient can be used to describe a substance or object that is able to return to its usual state after being changed in some way.
Okay. How about other words of interest?
So there's another term in the report that is likely new to our listeners. It is outpost. We define this word as a small place that is far away from any large towns or cities, and it can be used in two different ways. The first meaning relates to a very remote place in general. The other relates specifically to a remote place where a government or military organization has a presence. And this could include a small group of buildings or even a small town.
That's super helpful, Brian. Thanks again for joining us to explore some new vocabulary today.
You're welcome, Ashley. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger movement of organized labor in America. Sarah Long and Doug Johnson continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the most important results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger American labor movement.
Labor leaders had little success in organizing workers in the United States during the 1920s. Three Republican presidents and a national wave of conservatism prevented them from gaining many members or increasing their negotiating power. In 1929, organized labor fell even further with the beginning of the Great Economic Depression. By 1933, America's labor unions had less than 3 million members. But by the end of the 1930s, more than 10.5 million American workers belonged to unions.
New laws proposed by the Roosevelt administration made the labor growth possible. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 gave labor leaders the right to organize and represent workers. The Supreme Court ruled that the law was illegal. But another law, the Wagner Labor Relations Act of 1935, helped labor unions to increase their power. Most of the leaders of America's traditional labor unions were slow to understand their new power. They were conservative men. they represented workers with certain skills, such as woodworkers or metalworkers. They did little to organize workers with other kinds of skills. But a new group of labor leaders used the new laws to organize unions by industries, not by skills. They believed that workers would have much more power if they joined forces with other workers in the same factory to make common demands. These new leaders began to organize unions for the automobile industry, the steel industry, and other major industries.
The leader of the new movement was the head of the mine workers, John L. Lewis. Lewis was a powerful leader with a strong body and strong opinions. He had begun to work in the coal mines at the age of 12. Lewis rose to become a powerful and successful leader of the mine workers, but he was concerned about workers in other industries as well, and he believed that most of the leaders in the American Federation of Labor were doing little to help them. For this reason, Lewis and the heads of several other unions formed their own group to organize unions by industry, not by skills. They called their group the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and they tried immediately to gain members.
The CIO successfully organized the workers in several major industries, but it succeeded only by hard work and struggle. The CIO's first big battle was against the giant automobile company, General Motors. Late in 1935, workers at several General Motors factories began a sit-down strike at their machines to demand better pay and working conditions. After 45 days, General Motors surrendered. It recognized that the Automobile Workers Union had the right to represent GM workers, and it agreed to negotiate a new work agreement.
The struggle at the Ford Motor Company was more bitter. Ford Company guards beat union organizers and workers. But the Ford Company finally agreed to negotiate with the new union. The same story was true in the steel industry. But the new labor leaders succeeded in becoming the official representatives of steel workers throughout the country. By 1938, the CIO had won its battle to organize major industries. In later years, it would join with the more traditional American Federation of Labor to form the organization that remains the most important labor group in America today, the AFL-CIO.
President Roosevelt was not always an active supporter of organized labor, but neither was he a constant supporter of big business, like the three Republican presidents before him. In fact, Roosevelt spoke out often against the dangers of big business in a democracy. These speeches caused great concern among many of the traditional business and conservative leaders of the nation. And Roosevelt's increasingly progressive policies in 1935 made many richer Americans fear that the president was a socialist, a dictator, or a madman. Former President Herbert Hoover, for example, denounced Roosevelt's New Deal policies as an attack on the whole idea of individual freedoms. The family of business leader J.P. Morgan told visitors not to say Roosevelt's name in front of Morgan. They said it would make his blood pressure go up.
This conservative opposition to Roosevelt grew steadily throughout 1935 and 36. Many Americans were honestly worried that Roosevelt's expansion of government was the first step to dictatorship. They feared that Roosevelt and the Democrats were trying to gain power as the Nazis did in Germany, the fascists in Italy, or the communists in Russia.
The Republican Party held its presidential convention in the summer of 1936. The party delegates chose Alfred Landon to oppose Roosevelt for president. Mr. Landon was the governor of the farm state of Kansas. He was a successful oil producer with conservative business views. But he was open to some of the social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal. Republicans hoped he would appeal to average Americans who supported mild reforms, but feared Roosevelt's social policies. The Democrats nominated Roosevelt and Vice President John Garner to serve a second term.
The main issue in the presidential campaign of 1936 was Franklin Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt campaigned across the country like a man sure that he would win. He laughed with the cheering crowds and told them that the New Deal had helped improve their lives. In New York, Roosevelt made a major speech promising to continue the work of his administration if he was reelected.
Of course we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. Of course we will continue to work for cheaper electricity in the homes and on the farms of America. For better and cheaper transportation. For low interest rates, for sounder home financing, for better banking, for the regulation of security issues, for reciprocal trade among nations, and my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
The Republican candidate, Alfred Landon, began his campaign by saying that many of Roosevelt's New Deal programs were good. But he said that a Republican administration could do them better and for less money. However, Landon's words became much stronger as the campaign continued. He attacked many of Roosevelt's programs. The campaign became increasingly bitter. Roosevelt said his opponents cared only about their money, not about other Americans. "I welcome their hatred," he said. Landon's supporters accused Roosevelt of destroying the nation's economic traditions and threatening democracy.
The nation had not seen such a fierce campaign in 40 years. But when it was over, the nation also saw a victory greater than any in its history. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alfred Landon in the election of 1936 by one of the largest votes in the nation's history. Roosevelt won every state except Maine and Vermont. The huge election victory marked the high point of Roosevelt's popularity. In our next program, we will look at the many problems he faced in his second administration.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.